welcome to Tea and Strumpets, a Regency romance review. I'm Zoe.
And I'm Kelsey.
And we just had such a funny conversation before we hit record, but I was like, no, we have to have it again. Today's book is a patron choice, and it's a Loretta Chase book. And Kelsey, have we read a Loretta Chase on the pod before?
Well, I could have sworn we actually covered Lord of Scoundrels because I read the book and I didn't read the other one. So I thought I just had read a single one for the podcast. But Zoe looked it up and apparently we have not done a Loretta Chase. So my bad.
We have not. And it's funny because I swear we've had this conversation too before.
I swear we
did. That we both thought we did it.
You know, it's really funny though, is when we're reading the synopsis, I'm going to refer back to Lord of Scoundrels a little bit. And you're going to be, everyone's going to be like, I don't know what they're talking about. Unless you read Lord of Scoundrels, in which case you'll be like, yay. So there we go. There's some throwback to there. There's some references to Lord of Scoundrels.
Yes.
I highly recommend reading it.
And besides that, if you have or haven't read this book or Lord of Scoundrels, then lucky you, because you're in for a treat.
Yeah, you're going to learn about this one, which is The Last Hellion by Loretta Chase. And it's really good. And I think you might lose some of it because the reality is we meet him in Lord of Scoundrel. We meet our hero in Lord of Scoundrel. And it's unpleasant. We don't like him. We say grr to him. And then you learn his backstory and oh my God.
Okay, well, that's for our general discussion, Kelsey.
I know. I tried not to talk about it, okay? But we will start you out with a little bit more information about Loretta Chase, since apparently we've given you none so far.
Yes.
So I am going to read you the About Loretta on her website, and it is in the form of a letter. So I will read you said letter. Dear reader, if you'd like to know a little about me, read on. I attended New England public schools. We diagrammed sentences. We were drilled in spelling and grammar. This brutal process proved useful in later life. It turned out that everything they taught me in school, including the evil word problems in math, was useful in later life. Too bad I forgot most of it. Didn't we all? My career at Clark University was not short. After earning a BA in only twice the usual time, I stayed on to work in clerical, administrative, and part-time teaching posts. There were other real jobs along the way, stints with jewelry and clothing retailers, and a Dickinsonian 6-month experience as a meter maid. But my main business in life was writing. This is why I majored in English instead of something useful that would lead to a real job with an actual salary. English majors must read mountains of books and write reams of papers. If only they would have paid me for being an English major, my life would have been perfect. I agree, Loretta. I felt that way about political science, concentrating in theory. Meanwhile, whether or not anyone wanted me to, I wrote plays, poetry, letters, and of course, the great American novel. The latter went on forever and happily remains unfinished to this day. But no one ever paid me for writing until after college graduation, when I started moonlighting as a corporate video scriptwriter. This led to the fateful meeting with a video producer who lured me into writing novels and eventually became Mr. Chase. The books resulting from this union have won a surprising number of awards, including the Romance Writers of America, RITA. It is almost as grand a job as being an English major. Yours sincerely, Loretta.
Oh, goodness. She is wonderful. And I am just, I'm actually really upset that this is only this a handful of Loretta Chase's that I've read. I've actually read the series. I think she has like the Mr. Impossible, Miss.
She does the, she's the, not the Misadventures in Matchmaking, but she does the like,
there's one series of hers that I think
dressmakers,
I've read.
The Dressmakers, the Sisters.
That's Loretta Chase? That's not Lorraine Heath? Oh my gosh.
No, Loretta Chase does the Dressmaker. She does the like Silk is for Seduction.
Yes, you have read that one.
Yes.
I have not. And this is what I'm saying. I have read too few. I've read her whole Carsington Brothers series.
There you
That's
go.
What it is. But I have read too few Loretta Chase's because let's be honest, this Scoundrel series, now that I've read two of them, I'm like, how have I not read the others? I didn't even know they were in a series. And I just, man, she is something. Yeah. So we do also have a history fact.
Yes, we do have a history fact. It is a brief one, and it is... in this, we are going to learn about a disease, very Sawbones of us.
It's so funny because I saw your first line here and I was like, oh, there's a Sawbones episode about that.
Yes. So if you have ever learned about Balto, the dog in Alaska, then you have learned about diphtheria. I'm not going to try to say the official documentation of this in science literature. I'm just going to say diphtheria, which is an acute bacterial infection spread by personal contact and was the most feared of all the childhood diseases for a very long time. Diphtheria may be documented back to ancient Egypt and Greece, but severe reoccurring outbreaks began only after 1700. One of every 10 children infected died from this disease. Symptoms ranged from severe sore throat to suffocation due to a false membrane covering the larynx. This disease primarily affected children under the age of 5. Until treatment became widely available in the 1920s, the public viewed this disease as a death sentence.
Very, very sad to think about. And every time I think about all of the poor children in these books that we read and the disease, I'm just so thankful that we live in 20 something and not 17 or 18 something.
Even I'm really happy we were born at the end of the 20th century instead of the beginning of the 20th century. Yes. The first 50 years was a little rough.
Yes. We have a few tropes today, too.
Yes.
We have a class difference. We have the guy falling first. Sorry. And the rake and the virgin.
Yes. And our main characters are Vera Alwyn Mallory, Duke of Ainswood, and Miss Lydia Grenville.
Yes. Vera, is that how we're saying it?
That's what I'm saying.
I can't see it any other way, guys. It's V-E-R-E. And if you have a different way of pronouncing that, please let us know.
I'm only saying it that way because in it, he was like, oh, they referenced the word verity. And so that's why I'm saying Vera, because
perfect.
It's like a shortened verity.
Yes.
So that's why.
Perfect. I'm glad that you caught that. I just read the book and forgot about thinking about how to pronounce anything as usual.
Fair enough. I do it all the time. Okay. We're going to start this with a general warning, though, guys. This is not a trigger warning. This is just a general warning. And it is, we will not do justice to this story and this synopsis. It is very dialogue heavy, and that is really a lot of the magic of this book. And so just by saying the plot points, we're going to lose a lot of that dialogue magic.
Yes, we are. And I want to say a big thank you to our patron, Catherine from Texas, for choosing this book. As a member of our aristocracy, this was Catherine's choice. And she said before we read it, I don't think you guys have done a Loretta Chase on the podcast. Have you?
She's correct. We have not.
She said, this was my first read by her, and I was surprised by how much I loved it. Well, what a first Loretta Chase. Anyhow, we'll be getting into a couple more of Catherine's thoughts as we get into our general discussion. But first, Kelsey, shall we take it away?
We shall. We will start with the prologue that will literally break your goddamn heart. Like, yep. Just
broken.
I was almost in tears at the end of it, like actual tears.
I think my jaw was on the floor. I was like, okay,
this
I
is
know we're
the
supposed
discussion
to talk about
part.
It later, but I really thought that by the time we got through the quick introduction of both of our main characters, we knew everything we needed to know about these characters. They were so beautifully and perfectly introduced.
Yes.
And immediately your heart went for both of them and you were rooting for both of them. And you were like, these people deserve happily ever after. I cannot wait to read it.
Yes. And so we shall. And we're just going to start with the breaking of your heart. So it starts at the funeral of Vere's best friend and cousin, Charles, 5th Duke of Aynswood. For some reason, he saw fit to make Vere the guardian of his 3 children, which includes Robin, now the 6th Duke of Aynswood, who is the youngest of the 3. And Vere is very furious at fate. He is also furious. he is furious at fate, but he also recognizes the fury that is in Robin. So he takes Robin on the road with him. He meant to stay away from the kids, but he took comfort in comforting his cousin's son, who was only 9 years old, which is about the same age Vere was when he lost his parents. They travel around for 6 months, and then at the urging of Charles's sisters, Vere returns Robin to the rest of his family so he can continue his education and not be under the terrible influence of Vere, the last Mallory Hellion. Sadly, after only 3 weeks, Vere is called back because Robin has caught diphtheria and is on his deathbed. Vere makes it back just in time to hold the boy's hand as he passes. Quote, "Give it up, please," Vere urged, choking back tears, stifling the useless grief. "It's too soon for you, Robin. You know it is. You scarcely begun to live. You don't know a fraction of it, what there is to see, to do." The young Duke's eyelids fluttered and opened. Something like recognition seemed to flicker there. For an instant, his mouth shaped a ghost of a smile. Then the boy's eyes closed. That was all. Though Vere went on talking, coaxing, pleading, though he clung to the little hand, he could not draw the disease away and into himself. He could do nothing but wait and watch, as he'd done so many times before. It was a short watch this time, the shortest, hardest of all. And that is how Vere becomes the reluctant 7th Duke of Aynswood.
A year and a half later, Vere still resents the title. He has done nothing but drink and wench, and in general try to drown out the fact that he is the last heir of the Mallory line. We know some of his misdeeds as they were chronicled in Lord of Scoundrels when he assumed Sebastian Ballister's new wife was a whore, the Marquess of Dane, if you remember. He then made things worse by declaring a driving race in which one man had to put down his horses after a bad accident. However, fate has a way of playing tricks on you, and he winds up saving a man, who turns out to be Bertie, Sebastian Ballister's jovial brother-in-law, from the path of one Lydia Grenville, who is driving a breakneck pace down the London streets.
Lydia is our heroine, and she is the orphan daughter of a lady who ran away with an actor. Her mother died when she was 10, and her sister died a few years later after contracting consumption while they were in debtor's prison with their father. She then went to live with her great aunt and uncle, who died about a year ago, which was when Lydia decided to try her hand at journalism in London. She is actually very popular and saved a magazine from bankruptcy after becoming the mystery author behind a very popular serial novel. She is also known for deep investigative journalism in the lower slums of London, most particularly showcasing the plight of London's lower class women. Right now, she is rushing to save a young woman who is about to be sold into prostitution against her will.
Vere pursues Lydia as she gets out of her vehicle and runs after the bod and the young girl. Vere is worried that in trying to save the girl, Lydia is going to start a riot, so he quickly teases her and makes light of the situation. He even reaches over and gives her a kiss in view of everyone. Quote, "Though she'd seen a great deal of the world, more of it than the majority of London's most polished sophisticates, male and female, she was not altogether as worldly as the world believed. No man had ever kissed Lydia Grenville before."
To which Lydia punches him in the face, lying him flat on his arse.
Instead of being deterred by this, Vere becomes a bit obsessed with Lydia. He finds her fascinating and a bit reckless. On Lydia's end, Vere seems to keep showing up at the most inopportune moments. He believes he's saving her from her reckless self, and she thinks he's following her to get even for publicly humiliating him.
As Vere follows her, they do get into some interesting places. There is the time he comes across her dressed as a man and then proceeds to help her covertly get her clothes back and change into them. There is the time he finds her dressed as a gypsy after speaking with one of her informants, and they get into a Shakespeare quote-off.
So good.
Quote. He caught up with her near Russell Street. Planting himself in her path, he withdrew the cluster of straggling bouquet bouquets from under his arm, where he'd absently stowed them, and held them out to her. "Sweets to the sweet," he quoted from Hamlet. With a shrug, she took the crushed flowers. "Farewell," she said, and started to move away. "You mistake me," he said, following. That was the beginning. "So it was," she said, "but the line ends with farewell." Then Queen Gertrude scatters the flowers. Suiting action to words, she strewed the posies about her. "Mad for you," he cried poignantly. A harlot nearby giggled. Nothing daunted, he announced to the onlookers, "Into the desolate darkness of my weary existence she came, all burning color like the aurora borealis. Oh, heavenly powers, restore him," she wailed, "and lit me ablaze," he went on in stirring accents. "Behold me burning for a smile from these ruby lips. Behold me consumed in the sweet fire of undying devotion."
All the while, Vere is stealing kisses, and even after realizing Lydia is a virgin and has no interest in affair, he cannot stay away. Lydia finds Vere annoying and attractive, yet she can see the damage that can be done to a woman in a bad marriage, and she has never been interested in losing her freedom to the joys of matrimony.
By chapter 10, though, things are progressing nicely, and Lydia is finally ready to submit to letting him bed her. But instead, Vere surprises her by asking her to marry him. It really came out of the blue, guys.
So out of the blue.
I was like, nope, I gotta do it. Anyway, she refuses, of course, even after Vere puts in a few very solid points to the benefits of being a duchess. And since the two of them cannot seem to help themselves, their marriage becomes predicated on who wins a race.
If Lydia wins the race, there will be no more talk of marriage, and Vere will give £5,000 to Tamsin, the girl who Lydia saved the day they met, as a dowry. If Vere wins, quote, "Are the stakes too high for you?" she asked. "Perhaps you are not so sure, after all, of my incompetence." "I'd like to know how you are sure of mine," he said. "And what will you stake, Grenville?" He advanced another pace to loom over her, his mocking green gaze slanting down his nose as though she were ever so small and inferior. "How about your precious freedom? Are you confident enough to risk that?" "My freedom, then," she said, her voice low and hard, her chin high. "If I can't beat you, I'll marry you."
Despite them both knowing it was a silly idea, they both turn up to the race. Tamsin and Bertie are in tow. The two of them have a bit of a thing going on as well. I'm talking about Tamsin and Bertie. And frankly, It's adorable.
It is.
Things go well until a storm comes in just as they hit the worst part of the road. Vere tries to convince Lydia to call off the race. They'll call it a wash, no one wins, no one loses, but Lydia is stubborn and will not lose to him. In the end, it is not Lydia who was in danger, but Vere, whose horse is frightened by the lightning on the way down a hill, breaking loose of the carriage, which then crashes. Bertie was able to jump to safety, but Vere is thrown out of the vehicle. Lydia immediately stops her carriage and rushes to him. Quote, "Don't you die on me, you beast," she choked past the burning thing in her throat. "I've grown attached to you. Oh, come, I never meant it. Oh, I shall be wretched. How could you, Ainswood? This is not fair, not sporting of you. Come, you've won." She shook him. "Do you hear me, you thick-headed coxcomb? You've won. I'll do it. The ring, the parson, the whole cursed business. Your duchess." She shook him again. "That's what you wanted, isn't it? Make up your mind. Now or never, Ainswood. This is your last chance. Wake up, damn you, and marry me." She choked back a sob. "Or I'll leave you as I found you." She bowed her head, despairing. "Here, in the mud, in a ditch, I knew you'd come to a bad end." He should have opened his eyes sentences ago. But he was afraid he'd wake up and find it was only a dream, his dragon girl scolding him and grieving for him. "I'd rather you, wicked girl, than all the seraphs in heaven. Will you have me, sweet? Do you mean it?" She let out a shaky sigh. "Yes, I mean it. Plague take you. And I am not sweet. Get up, you great fraud."
I am so glad you included that quote. I'm smiling from ear to ear. That was such a brilliant moment. And I think it also kind of really encapsulates the two of them.
100%. So, yeah. No, it was a definite one you had to put in there. Also, like, your dog was really excited over my dramatic reading, despite the fact that you've got headphones on.
I know. She's going crazy behind me. I don't know what's going on. Well. So our hero and heroine arrive at the inn and are married that day. Lydia then does try to back out, telling Veer she is really unworthy of sharing his title, but he will not hear of it. Then, after we have encounter number one, Veer finds out a bit of Lydia's secret history. It is done in dramatic fashion when he goes and knocks on the Marquess of Dane's door, who was there and gave Lydia away, and demands to know why he did not tell him that Lydia was a Ballister.
She has the distinctive Ballister birthmark, which he recognizes on her arse.
Lydia knew her mother was from an obscure branch, but had never approached Sebastian because she was worried he would not want an old scandal brought to light. Sebastian is all, "I'm Lord Beelzebub, and I welcome all family." He even insists on giving her a dowry. More importantly, though, he gives her her mother's diary, something she thought was lost forever.
So now Lydia has a husband and a new family in Sebastian and Jessica, who we met in Lord of Scoundrels. You should go read it, since apparently we've never covered it. As this is a romance tale, though, there is more excitement to be had.
Yes.
There's two...
At this point in the book, I was like, oh, I'm near the end. Wait, no, I'm only at 66%.
Yeah, there's like, way more to go.
Is this an Amanda Quick?
Right? Veer's two remaining wards are found to have run away from home and are now missing. Veer is beside himself with worry, but feels good knowing that Lydia's there acting as general. He does refer to her as the general. He is really desperately in love with her, but until she can say it to him, he does not want to say it aloud. Veer's wards end up making it to London, where they are met by Coralie, the woman who tried to kidnap Tamsin at the beginning of our tale. She has had it out for Lydia since Lydia rescued Tamsin, and also for stealing back Tamsin and also many other girls' stolen jewels.
Yeah, there was a jewel heist in the middle.
Yeah, there was a jewel heist. It's where they have a fun and, you know, sexy time moment. And then afterwards, Veer proposes to her because, anyway, neither here nor there. You got to read it.
There's too much. Let me sum up. It is a close thing, but Lydia is able to rescue the girls, and Veer comes in the nick of time to watch Lydia defeat Coralie in a knife fight. Lydia is cut, though, and faints as soon as Veer can get her. Susan, a very important piece of this story, the trusty canine sidekick, the trusty mastiff sidekick, also helped in the rescue effort.
Lydia is luckily not permanently damaged and is set about to recover from her ordeal with a scolding from Veer. Quote, "I'll never forgive you, Grenville," he said, his voice choked. "You are supposed to stay home and be the general. See, general. You are not supposed to go charging out on your own. I can't trust you out of my sight for a minute. I vow I must have died months ago and gone direct to hell, which is why I haven't hanged myself, because it would be redundant."
And as always, we get our hero admitting his love, because he could not live with himself if she died without ever telling her. I'm sorry. I see the quote you put. I think this was going to be my favorite quote. So everyone get ready. "The most precious," he disentangled his hand, then stood and walked to the windows. He stared into the garden. Then he came back to the bed. He stood at the foot, his hand wrapped around the bedpost. "What about love, Grenville? Do you think, in time, you might be so graciously condescending as to endure my love? Or is love only for mere mortals? Perhaps the godlike Ballisters have no more need for it than the Olympian deities need a curricle to take them down to Delphi, or a vessel to take them to Troy." She gazed at him for a long moment and sighed. "Ainswood, let me explain something to you," she said. "If you wish to make a declaration of love to your wife, the accepted form is to say simply, 'I love you.' The accepted form is not to dare and daunt and go about it in your usual belligerent way. This is supposed to be a tender moment, and you are spoiling it by making me want to throw a coal bucket at you."
I just love them so much.
Well, and the paragraph that she says after that, I have to pull it up because it's my favorite. Sorry. Hold on. I know that.
It's okay. I think I have it down at the bottom of favorite quotes. So,
"You're spoiling it by making me want to throw a coal bucket at you." He narrowed his eyes and set his jaw. "I love you," he said grimly. She pressed her hand to her breast and closed her eyes. "I am overcome with something. I do believe I shall swoon."
Okay, sorry. God, I love them. Okay. Veer also very self-consciously asks if she might ever consider saying the same to him. She tells him that of course she loves him. She may not always say it in those words, but she will always do everything to show her love for him. As always, our book ends with a cheeky reply between the two of them. A Ballister Devil, nothing less than a Mallory Hellion, would ever suit you.
We should also mention that Bertie and Tamsin get married. Sebastian and Vera were becoming good friends again. Jessica and Lydia are thick as thieves, and Vera's wards are coming to live with them because family is everything to Lydia, especially found family. Vera has told her that they can adopt as many stray people as she likes. Well, okay, shall we adjourn to the parlor? I can't wait to keep talking.
We shall. Let's make it quick.
All right. If you want to find us on social media, you can find us everywhere that we are at T as in Tom, N as in Nancy Strumpets. That would be Instagram, Twitter, my dog's going crazy, Facebook, and YouTube by searching our name.
If you're listening to us on YouTube, now is a great time to click that thumbs up and hit subscribe before you forget. Liking and commenting on our videos and subscribing to our channel is a really wonderful way to let us know that you like what we're doing.
And if you want to support us in another way, we, of course, have our Patreon, and we have three different tiers. We have $3, $5, and $10 a month. And if you are a $10 a month patron in our aristocracy, you get to choose a book for the podcast like our fabulous patron Catherine got to do today. We have fabulous rewards at every level, and we so appreciate any bit of support you can give us. And just listening to this podcast is also supporting us. So thank you so much.
Okay, let's talk about it.
Oh my God.
Okay.
Okay. So I'm going to go back to Catherine real quick. So
yes. Let's hear her thoughts.
Yeah, so she just wanted to know. She was surprised by how much she loved it. She also says, when we asked, do you have any questions or discussion points you'd like us to touch in our discussion about it? She just said, this book was published in 1998. Thoughts on older historical romance novels as compared to newer ones coming out now. This is great. We will touch on that, I'm sure, as we go, because I do have some things to say about that. Because this one felt so contemporary.
It did not feel 1998 at all. I could tell a bit from the writing style and a bit how like the hero was portrayed. However, like totally contemporary vibe as far as like hero heroine interaction, discussions.
Yes.
Continuations. Anyway, back to the top.
So she also says, anyone familiar with Lord of – so I also – we also ask our patrons, do you have any thoughts you'd like to have shared about this book that you haven't included already? So she wrote, anyone familiar with Lord of Scoundrels will recall how skillfully Loretta Chase recounted Dane's backstory in the book's prologue, and now introducing us to an unloved child who believed himself unlovable. Here, the author yet again introduces her hero in an incredibly poignant manner, and all I will say about the prologue to The Last Hellion is this. Have a box of tissues handy. You'll need them.
Yes, we did. Hi, Oliver. How's it going? What you doing?
This is a dog-heavy episode.
Okay. My first comment and general thoughts was, I just want to read everyone the prologue. It's beautifully written. It's gut-wrenching, and the book just gets better from there. But the prologue itself, it sweeps you away. You feel the heartache, and you instantly feel the redemption story coming through. It's gut-wrenching. It's beautifully written. It immediately sweeps you up, and having met Ainswood as a negative character, we don't like him in Lord of Scoundrels, it's immediately you understand the redemption story. You understand where he was when the events of Lord of Scoundrel takes place, and your heart literally breaks for him.
Well, and what's so incredible about this book is, he's awful at the beginning. But you get this like terrible thing that you get this backstory about all the terrible things that happened to Vere. Mm-hmm. But Loretta Chase actually shows his evolution through the book.
Yeah.
He he personally admits to his shortcomings and the fact that he didn't acknowledge his grief, that he buried himself in the whoring and the drinking because he couldn't face the death anymore. Mm-hmm. He couldn't face all of the terrible things that had happened to him, and especially losing Robin. Like, that just, that broke him.
Also protecting himself. He does not want to find another person into his life to care about. It's why he's left his other two wards with their aunt. And instead of doing anything with them, he's like, I've ignored them because, one, they're young women, so they don't need to be around me. But two, he can't care about anyone else because what if that person dies? He can't handle that death anymore.
Yeah, it's heart-wrenching. And then there's Lydia, who also has her own heart-wrenching story. Mm-hmm. And, you know, but she's just so interesting because this, to me, this really is a little bit of like the flipped usual tropes. Like, you have the man that falls first, which I think in 1998, are you kidding me? Like, I don't, how have I not heard of this book before?
And also, that was what I thought about this whole time. He's a total libertine wenching this. Everyone says, oh, he doesn't, like, women are only good for one thing for him. He really does not care what's going on. He's only ever with one woman once. Like, once he uses you, he's done with you. And that's how he's portrayed. And you see him really, but he doesn't act like it. You know what I mean? Like, those heroes act a certain way, and he does tell Lydia she's reckless, and he doesn't think that she's doing anything. Like, he's trying to help her, and in helping her, like, does more harm than good half the time. But so he still is belittling her, but at the same time, too, he's like, you're going to go do these things. I just want to make sure I'm there to, like, help you if you need me.
He is a hellion. He knows he is. He recognizes he is. And he sees it in Lydia too. And he's like, well, better that there's two of us than one. You know, like, it's so wonderful. He enables her.
He does. He 100% does. Hence, they have to have a carriage race across, like, miles of road because he's like, well, let's make it a bet then. Because she won't marry him.
Yeah. Him, the you know, crazy hellion Rake is like, no, I submit, basically. Like, fine, I don't want you to get hurt. Like, let's just call it a draw. And she's like, hell no. Boom.
I know.
Which I hate her for a little bit, but I also, like, I just love the characterization of it. And I love when, oh my God, when she is admitting, or he is admitting his love for her, that whole scene that we were reading, it keeps going because she, you know, because she, like you wrote in the thing, like, she doesn't quite say I love you, but I'm going to read you this other quote, which is like, you've told me, she said, in hundreds of ways. I didn't need the three magic words, though. I didn't need the three magic words, though I'm glad to hear them. Glad, he repeated. Well, that's better, I suppose. You're glad to own my heart. He released her hands. Perhaps when you're feeling stronger, you might muster up more enthusiasm. In any case, as soon as you're quite well again, I'll start working on capturing yours. Perhaps in a decade or two, you might be sufficiently softened to return my feelings. I most certainly will not, she said as he stepped back and started to undress. He paused, staring at her. Why in the blazes should I return them, she said. I mean to keep them in my heart. She pointed there, where I keep my own, where it says, I love you, comma, and then all your names and titles.
I love it, and all your names and titles.
Are you kidding me? Like, Lydia is so great.
I also love the fact that even after they're married, he never calls her Duchess or this. He still calls her Grenville. He's like,
which is kind of weird.
It is kind of weird, but I think at the same time, too, he's acknowledging her for her own person and what she's accomplished, and that does not get, like, superseded because he's given her his last name. She is still her own person. He will still treat her as that equal they were beforehand because her fear of marriage was that she was going to have to submit to, like, the despot husband and, like, have to live at his whims. And instead he's like, no, we're still on that equal footing. Like, he does refer to her as Lydia too, but that's in, like, tender moments, not when he's like just talking barely. To her. It's like, you're Grenville.
Yeah. No, I think that's interesting. And I think it's good. I just thought it was a little bit weird because, okay. So real quick, I'm going to just throw in that there's a lot more weird plot that happens. There's
there's a lot of weird plot.
The jewel heist and there's the
Lydia's secret family history.
And it's like, we find out that actually her dad, Grenville, wasn't her dad.
Yeah.
And like that her dad was actually a different Ballister cousin.
No, he was a Ballister bastard.
Yeah, Ballister bastard. And so anyhow, it's just like she's really Ballister.
Yeah, she's Ballister on both sides.
Yeah, but pretty distant, allegedly. But it just was kind of weird where I was like, we didn't even need that. Like, it didn't even feel like we needed that extra bow, but we got like an extra bow on the story. Mm-hmm. And so it was just kind of interesting, all of the things that happened. In general, though, like we said at the beginning, this is so conversation and banter driven. Mm-hmm. And I love it so much. It is such a smart book. Yeah. It is so witty. It is so great.
We were texting back and forth just to show the banter in the sense. I was like, I love the fact that every time Veer refers to Lydia to somebody else or even in his own head, he has like a different set of names to call her. It's like, yes. Miss Impetuous blah 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 Grenville. Like, yeah. Miss whatever.
He calls her a dragon. He calls her a monster. In the beginning, he calls her a monster so much. And I love it because he's like, you'd think that that's such a derogatory thing, but it's like the most, you can tell he's not calling her a monster to his face. He's like calling her a monster in his internal dialogue. And you can tell he loves this monster.
No, like, and I love it too because his pet name for her is like Dragoness. It's like, yes. And he does, that's how he refers, becomes from the monster to the dragoness, and he just refers to her like that in his head all the time. And I'm like, I love it because you recognize the strength and power that is there, and you're not trying to tame it or capture it. You just want to be in her orbit.
Yeah. There's just a great line that is early on in the book. And he wondered what malignant power had created this shockingly beautiful monster.
Yeah.
You know, like all the malignant. And so anyhow, I just love all of the everything. And I wish I feel like there are so many really amazing, smart, incredible things that Loretta Chase is doing with this book. And I just like, I'm not going to be able to articulate any of them at 8:15 p.m. on a weeknight.
No.
Like, and even if I had more time and I was not tired and all these things, like, man, just this book's so great.
I know. I'm going to skip us to our hero heroine rating. We've kind of talked about the two of them and what we like about them. I'm just going to go ahead and give them both a 10.
Yeah, because they both get 10s for me.
They're 10s for me across the board. Like, they are intrinsic to the story. They are who they are. I love that no one – there really isn't, like – there's not a compromise. It's not like they have to compromise to be together. And I mean that almost in a negative way where you feel like you're kind of disappointed because they had to give up something that was intrinsically them in order to like fit the mold. They don't do that. And she's like, I won't be a good duchess. And he's like, I'm literally called the last Mallory Hellion. I don't think it matters.
Yes. I mean, I can't say much more than we have already said, like without just repeating myself, but they are both so strong. They are so interesting and wonderful. I believe in them. I want them to succeed. Mm-hmm. I love every moment of them on the page. They couldn't be more perfect.
Yeah.
They have such great character development, mm-hmm. and they give you so much back as a reader.
Yeah.
10 out of 10, both of them.
Yeah, super 10 out of 10. Okay. So for favorite quotes, I have like a bunch in here.
It's really hard. We're going to have to just read them.
I highlighted so much. I think I've highlighted more in this book than I have any other book. Like every other page I was highlighting something. I highlighted like half the prologue.
Yeah.
Okay, I'm just going to start reading. Some of these are funny. Some of these are silly. Some of these are, I think I put my heart-wrenching ones in there. But anyway, number one, Dane went to the wardrobe and went on. Oh, so this is when, context, skip that part. Okay, so this first quote is when they find out that Veer's wards are missing and they rally the troops, as in everyone they've ever known, to help search. And so this is, we're with the Marquess of Dane at the moment. Dane went to the wardrobe and went on talking while he emptied its contents. I should have been there when they laid Charlie to rest. I should have been with Ainswood when they lay the boy with his father. A man ought to have his friends with him at such times. And Ainswood had no friend in Charles. And Ainswood had no friend in Charlie's sisters, I'll tell you, or their husbands. He threw a heap of clothes on the bed and paused, looking at Bertie. At least he's asked this time for help. Doubtless that's my cousin's doing. The next one, is when after they have found Lydia's. So these are tied together. And this is after Dane gave Lydia her mother's diary back. And so she basically stays up all night reading passages to Fear. Now while there was silence and what should have been peace, he felt as though he'd been both captain and crew on a vessel tossed upon the rocks after a day and night of battling a furious tempest. He might have managed to put into a safe harbor if it hadn't been for the little book. Its contents were the rocks he seemed to have foundered upon. At least a dozen times while he'd listened to the voice, his wife's, he'd wanted to tear the book from her hands and throw it in the fire. The words of a woman 18 years dead had dug into him as few others' words could do, and made him feel like a cur and a coward. She'd borne her lot with courage and humor, while he couldn't face what had happened on his wedding night. He'd leapt at the chance to quarrel with Dane. Eagerly used anger to blot out the other thing, as though what he had to bear, one disagreeable realization, were the most excruciating thing in the world. It wasn't. The joke was on him. That was all. He'd wanted Grenville, hadn't he? As he'd never wanted any other woman. Why then should he be so amazed that when he'd finally bedded her, it wouldn't be like bedding any other woman? With the others, he'd merely coupled. With his wife, he'd made love.
Ah, such a good quote, too.
This is another conversation between Dane and Ainswood. And this is with the wedding, the two of them are basically, their friendship is coming back. And that's something Ainswood has missed, but he was such an ass that he understands why Dane didn't want to be his friend, but they're coming back together. Quote, I am well aware your interest lies elsewhere. You did not marry her for her mind. It is inconceivable to you that she, any woman, has one. Well, let me tell you something, Ainswood. They do. They are always thinking, women are. And if you don't wish to be outmaneuvered at every turn, I recommend you exercise your very thick and sluggish brain in comprehending your wife's. I know this is hard for you. Thinking upsets the delicate balance of your constitution. I am trying to make it easier by telling you what I know. We men must stick together.
Ugh. These boys, it's funny because I saw someone on Instagram recently say, like, I want books where, like, the men help each other and like to get women. And I'm just like, well, first of all, I recommended the Bromance Book Club because it's literally the premise. But I was also thinking as I read this one that there's actually, I'm banging my mic so much. Sorry, listeners. I actually was thinking as I read this one that it has so much of that male camaraderie, and like not just in the way that sometimes it happens where it's like, oh, you know, these women, ha ha ha. Mm-hmm. But like actually like we need to be better.
Yeah.
You know, like we need to realize that there's a lot more going on than everybody's trying to tell you. Mm-hmm. So I have a few quotes as well. Yay. Let's see how many I go through. So this is somewhere like early-ish on as Ainswood keeps following her around. So he had nothing burdening his heart and most certainly had no idiotish wish to unburden himself to her. He had no reason to fear he'd be tempted to do so simply because he'd learned, in reading her work, that she was not so cynical and stony-hearted, not so much the dragon on a rampage when it came to children. This couldn't possibly matter to him, because he was cynical and stony-hearted about everything. He was the last Mallory Hellion, obnoxious, conceited, conscienceless, etc., etc. And because he was, he had only one use for her, and seeking a sympathetic ear wasn't it. He did not confide in anyone because he'd nothing to confide, and if he had, he'd rather be staked under a broiling sun in the Sahara than confide in a female. He told himself this in several different ways during the journey home, and not once did it occur to the Duke of Ainswood that he might be protesting too much.
Ah, because she doth protest too much.
It was so good. I mean, just like this characterization that Loretta Chase does, even in the, just, you know, the internal dialogue, it's so good here. Are you kidding? Oh, like, you're reading that and you're like, okay, he's being an idiot, but then it didn't occur to him that he was protesting too much. It's just this cheeky thing where the writer is bringing the reader into it, right? Yeah. Like, we're cohorts now. Oh, and it's so good.
This is something – sorry, I'm going to interrupt for a second because this is a thought I meant to say at the beginning, which was
– yes.
Lydia is so great because she's like, the Duke of Ainswood, he's got this reputation. But she does a little digging into his history and how he became the Duke, and she finds all the, like – I think it was like 12 funerals in 10 years or something like that. And she's like, oh my God, this poor man. Like, she sees past that, even though she's not willing, but she doesn't capitulate to him. She doesn't try to pet him and like try to coax him into telling her her feelings. She looks at it and she's like, oh, this man must be hurting so much. I think I understand him a little bit better. And that's it. But it's for her own internal, and it's not like they ever really, like, go into it all, but it's something similar to this. It's one of those moments of she's realizing this, thinking it to herself, and that's part of her character and what then, like, takes, you know, things happen again. And it's just, ah, so great. It's not as eloquently as that section. That was a good line. He does doth protest too much. Ah.
All right, let me find my next quote. I wrote the word quote on it. Sorry, I just have so many highlighted.
That's okay.
Here it is. So this is later after she has decided to become the Duchess. This is Lydia talking. Quote, I am not subject to nervous fits, Miss Impertinence. I am not in any sort of misery. I am perfectly composed. She stalked to the door. In a short while, I shall be the Duchess of Ainswood. And then she glared at Tamsin. The rest of you peasants had better look out.
Oh, I love her so much.
The thing is, like, you know, if you have no context about Lydia, you're like, oh, she's a bitch. But the thing is, like, she's so not.
She's just saying it because she's frustrated and she knows that Tam's, like, and she's known for being so giving and caring and, like, taking care of everyone. And she does not think of herself as above in any way, shape, or form. And it's so funny, yeah, to see her be like, and you peasants better watch out.
Yeah, because she's just trying to get everybody to, like, go away. Well, I would love to share, like, 17 more, but we're going so over our normal time here that
yeah, we need to keep going, but yeah, because I could literally just read you the, why don't I just read you the book? I feel like,
oh yeah, can we do that? Is it you know, in the common license yet? Unfortunately not. All right, steaminess, encounters, you wrote three. I think there might have been four because there was some touching at the very first encounter. The hand did go under the skirt. I don't know if you caught that one. But regardless.
3 to 4.
Let's talk about the steaminess.
Steamy.
What did you think?
You know, I thought it was a good cup of tea. It wasn't like the hottest thing I'd ever read.
Yeah.
Like, I wasn't like, oh God, oh God. But, you know, I think it was perfectly in the right vein. I thought it was explicit, but not super explicit. I thought, like, it definitely was the culmination of the tension. I did laugh at their first encounter because he, like, enters her and she screams and she's like, apologies. It didn't actually hurt that bad. Sorry, bad. Keep going.
Yeah. She was like, am I doing this wrong? Or was there like this moment? She was like, oh, I didn't. Yeah.
He's like, oh God, did it hurt you? She's like, oh no, it's fine. I surprised myself. Sorry.
Yeah. It didn't change tones. Their banter didn't change tones significantly in the bedroom, which was great. It wasn't like all of a sudden you had two different people. I think, like, I agree. It totally was fine, but it's also like this book was so good that I didn't even care about the steamy parts.
No, I thought it was fitting with the sexual tension. I didn't need a huge explosion. Yep. I just needed a continuation of the sexual tension.
Yes. And then also the arguing, and then, but then they work together to like solve a common problem. And then he lets her save the day, and he doesn't get mad at her for kind of deviating and going out on her own. He agrees that she did the right thing because there was nothing, there was no other option, and the day was saved. And
oh my God, I love the fact too, because he sees her in this like fight, and instead of trying to wade in, he's like, oh, I'm going to do more damage than good if I like get in there. Even Susan, the Mastiff, doesn't know where to go. She's kind of circling, and he's there, and he just basically like hypes up Lydia, and she basically is like, thank you. I needed that. I was tiring. That lady was wily and she was playing dirty, and I was really reaching the end of what I could do. And like your being there and telling me to get it over with and get it done, like really rallied the troops there.
Yes, yes, yes. It was so good. And that kind of rolls right into our feminist recap. I feel like we could spend, I don't know, a 10-episode series talking about why and how this book is feminist. I think there are so many great things about it. I think we've already touched on all those things. The one thing I will say is, it being 1998, there were two terms that were used in this book that I wasn't sure that we would use today, even though we're talking about something historically. So gypsy is one of them. And I don't actually know if Romany is the correct term for it nowadays or what. I don't know. I don't know what would be the correct thing to feel about talking about and writing about. It'd be really interesting. I think maybe Sarah McLean might be a person, like if we ever talk to her, that she might have some better thoughts. Or those of you who listen to Fated Mates, I admit I don't, just because I'm, well, it would take me too long to explain why I'm bad at things like this. But if there's an episode about gypsies or Romany, I really should read it. Or maybe Shelf Love has a good episode. So anyhow, the point is that. Also, street Arabs. So at the end of the book, so she gets these street Arabs to help her. And I was actually unfamiliar with that term, and I meant to look it up before we recorded, but I didn't. So I was curious if that just – I mean, in a way – you know, this is 1998, and here we do have Loretta Chase, like, introducing somebody who's not white, like, you know, into the book, with not just the, you know, and not just aristocracy. So I was a little bit like, oh, well, there's a little bit of diversity in this world. And I think that's maybe a little bit advanced for 98, even though, and they're helpful, good characters. They're not portrayed in a bad way, but I still was just like, that's an interesting conversation that maybe, like, you know, would be one part of our 10-part series if we were going to talk about the feminism in this book. But yeah, I don't know. Any thoughts on your end?
No, I think you covered it. I think that I agree. I think that this book is mostly feminist. I think that maybe some language, some terms might need updating, but again,
not much.
I think that it was.
I mean, especially the way that they have their relationship. It's just, yeah, I'm into it. All right, final book rating.
It's a 10.
It's a 10 from you. Okay, so I think this book deserves a 10. The only thing I'm going to say is that during the middle, I felt like it lulled a little bit and it felt a little slow. And I was just like trying to get through a little bit of it, but then of course it just picked up and like blew me out of the water again. So I don't know if maybe I just was tired, but what can you give this book other than a 10?
I mean, you're allowed to give it not a 10. I'm just going to give it a 10. I loved this book. I absolutely 100% loved it. I loved the characters. I wouldn't change anything about it. I loved it.
I couldn't recommend a book more. It's a 10, period.
Yeah.
Well, Catherine.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Thanks, Catherine.
What a great book. I hope we just, if you haven't read it, I hope we convince you to read it. There is so much to discover in this book. Every line of conversation, every little nuance. There's a lot that happens, and a lot we didn't get into, and I just hope people pick it up because, man, it was a good book.
Yeah, it really was. I actually went back and I read another book in the Scoundrel series because I was just really vibing. So I read, it's technically number 3 in the book, but it's very odd because it's number 3, but we do meet the character in this book, Francis Beaumont, the like guy who came over from France.
Yeah, he's a villain because he doesn't get totally knocked off in this book. So I was wondering.
He gets knocked off in the other one.
Okay.
But it's about his wife, the artist, and like that past. And it's very interesting because there's like a spy with his own crazy history. And like that one's very much like Amanda Quick-esque, like very adventurous and spy-y and like very crazy. So
I'll have to try it out.
It wasn't as great as this one, but like it was still a really good book. Like it was definitely like it kept me going on my Loretta Chase like train that I was on.
Well, how wonderful. I am currently reading our next patron or our first patron pick for our Patreon goal that we hit. Maybe I'll get that one on there into my TBR. However, Kelsey, what are we reading next time?
So we are reading a book off our list of books to look out for. And this is a book. This is one that we really liked the concept of. It's Anna Maria and the Fox by Liana de la Rosa.
Yes, I'm really excited. This is going to be a new release. It comes out, I think, on April 4th. So Kelsey and I are going to be reading it. And then we hope you read it too and join us for the discussion in the second half of April. And we so appreciate your support. Thank you so much for listening. Thank you so much for reading. And join us next time as we read Anna Maria and the Fox by Liana de la Rosa.
And may all your ever afters end happily.